today on Against the Grain, classrooms are places of teaching and learning. What if they were also places of healing and liberation? I'm CS. We'll revisit a conversation with Tessa Hicks Peterson about her book, Liberating the Classroom, Healing and Justice in Higher Education, coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Chances are, if you went to college, you were fed a lot of information. Your teachers had material to convey, a syllabus to get through, exams to administer. The focus was course content. What else could it have been? Tessa Hicks Peterson believes education must do more. It should, she contends, ignite healing and wholeness, empowerment and liberation. How that can happen, how that vision can be realized, is the subject of her new book, Liberating the Classroom, Healing and Justice in Higher Education. Tessa Hicks Peterson is Assistant Vice President of Community Engagement and professor of urban studies at Pitzer College. When Tessa and I connected recently, I asked what she was trying to do with this book.
My primary aim with the book is to uplift in the conversation about education these ideas of well-being and justice. And by that, I mean thinking about how teachers and students and administrators, all of us, need to be really respected for who we are and a sense of mattering and belonging and purpose in the work that we do, which leads to greater sense of well-being, fulfillment, and can also be healing for the spaces in our lives where we have been told we don't matter or we have not been treated with, you know, our rights and respect and dignity. So it's really just making sure that these things that are so important not only to our democracy, to our country, to our communities, but to our individual well-being, that those things are served and centered in our educational spheres where so much of our lives are spent and inform who we are and the work that we do in the world.
Is it your sense that well-being and healing, that there isn't enough focus on those kinds of things in classrooms, in educational settings?
I think our educational system is a product of the larger systems we're a part of, capitalism and the rest, which really put a focus on our worth being determined by what we produce. And that does not always lend itself to putting a focus on who we are and what we bring to the table and how our mind, body, and spirits are faring. So no, I don't think we often lead with how are we doing and how can we be well together in community and in this society. So we do actually have to re-socialize ourselves to the importance of that community care, collective care, which I think is our birthright and has been a part of traditions and cultures across the world from the beginning of time, but sort of gets lost oftentimes in the rapid pace and hyper-individualism and intense hyper-production focus of the world we live in today. And we can get mired in competition and isolation and all kinds of different things that are deteriorating to our personal health as well as our collective health.
What about the other focus, which is justice in higher education? You know, universities are often portrayed as sort of, you know, left-wing, progressive institutions, and one could presumably one might assume that that includes a focus on justice in the classroom. Did you see that improvements of a sort in that area could be made and should be made?
Absolutely. The rates of injustice in our society today are still so high. And of course, we have come a long way. But there's, you know, basic statistics like the amount of money that a woman makes compares to a man, 70-something percent to the dollar. Right? There's these things that persist. The level of achievement and graduation rates for students of color versus white students is still has a disparity that is just unfathomable. And we can see that in disciplinary procedures, the way that students of color are treated compared to white students and how they're disciplined, expelled, suspended. I mean, there's so many different pieces of evidence that we can point to about how injustice exists today in the classroom. And these are representative of the injustices that exist in the world today. And we already know the rates of incarceration for folks of color. And not this is not only just a race issue, I've been pointing to that, but of course, it's also around lines of gender, sexual orientation and identity, religion. There's so many ways in which bias and discrimination come to play in systemic ways. And that is definitely prevalent in our education system, likewise in our housing and our economic and other systems as well. But I'm focusing here on education. So I think, yes, of course, colleges are seen as bastions of liberal thought and the like, but I think the realities of injustice of society still seep into those spaces in major ways, and we are accountable to addressing them and to really, really addressing the root conditions to how, you know, systems of education were created by and for white men primarily at their start. And of course, we've changed a great deal over the years, but we have to, in our nation as a whole and in our school systems in particular, really dismantle the ideologies and the power structures and the ways of thinking that originally went into the creation of these systems that were created on the basis of the foundation of slavery and genocide upon which this country was founded. All of that seeps into every system of our nation, and education is a really important one. And if we want to really change the future so that we don't keep rubbing up against injustice everywhere we turn, then we have to start where we teach and learn and create, you know, the future leaders of our country in these institutions. So I understand the prejudice or the stereotypes that exist about colleges being liberal spaces already. And I just think we have so much more work to do. It's much more beyond that superficial, you know, ideal of the college scene as such.
So one focus of your book, Liberating the Classroom, authored by my guest, Tessa Hicks Peterson, is what you call trauma-informed, equity-centered, healing education. I want to spend some time on this, and let's start with how you define trauma.
So yeah, let me just also say that trauma is an overused and often misunderstood term today, and I think it can be off-putting for people because it's thrown around so much. And not every single person who experiences trauma or traumatic events will be traumatized. But trauma, the idea of trauma, results from individual or collective incidents that threaten our lives and can have adverse effects into the future, directly, indirectly, sometimes intergenerationally, on the mental, physical, social, emotional well-being of individuals and communities. Trauma can be big events like an earthquake or a car accident or a genocide, obviously huge events. It can be smaller, more intimate events like sexual violence within a family. And oftentimes the individual events can be linked to larger systemic issues. So sexual violence within a family against women can be emblematic of larger sexist sexual violence against women in the country, right? So these are both small intimate issues as well as large systemic issues. And these impact our young people's lives in many ways. And so I do believe that to educate fully to the best of our ability, we need to be trauma-informed as teachers, but also equity and healing-centered. And I can talk about all of those different pieces as we move along in the conversation.
So what sorts of impacts can trauma have on a person's ability or desire to learn in educational settings?
So oftentimes young people have experienced trauma and come into the classroom with that, and it can result in a variety of things. And there's no one thing across the board that's true for everyone, of course, but it can result in a lack of trust and oftentimes feeling triggered or threatened by things that resemble or remind the person of the initial trauma, and they might react in that moment as if they're in the actual threat of trauma, even if they're not. Our minds can make us believe we are in that way and then react defensively or in a reactionary way where we're thinking in binaries, black and white. We don't really have the same level of nuance or complexity and the ability to cognitively make sense of what's going on, which is very difficult if you're in a classroom that requires you to really sit in the gray space and trying to understand complex ideas and have hard conversations where we might have differing points of views. It makes it very difficult if we are wrapped up in a more reactionary black and white way of thinking in that moment. And if teachers can be aware of what that is, what the symptoms are, what it looks like, then they can negotiate perhaps better around working with kids who might come in with trauma and also not reproduce it unwittingly through the ways that they're acting that might actually perpetuate that sort of reaction. So it's about harm reduction as well as attempting to mitigate some of the impacts of trauma and maybe even on the flip side, create a more nurturing learning environment that can actually, in the end, create some healing for the student experience.
Tessa Hicks Peterson is my guest. She is Assistant Vice President of Community Engagement and a Professor of Urban Studies at Pitzer College. We are talking about her new book, Liberating the Classroom, Healing and Justice in Higher Education. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm C.S. Song. So one way in which you maybe illustrate the application of this trauma-informed, equity-centered, healing education approach that you refer to, and yeah, we will talk more about the equity-centered component of that, is by presenting a vignette. And this vignette is rooted in your school's, Pitzer College's, Inside Out Prison Exchange Program. Tell us about the program. What does it involve?
It's a wonderful program that was started over 25 years ago at Temple University by Lori Pompa and a number of incarcerated students who created a classroom environment whereby approximately 10 college students from a local campus would come into a local prison where approximately 10 incarcerated college students would come together and make a class for the whole semester. And the entire semester's class, instead of taking place on campus, would take place inside the prison because obviously the incarcerated students could not get out to go to campuses for college. So bringing that college experience inside the prison. Now, oftentimes prisons offer college classes, but oftentimes it's just with those inside. And the difference here is to bringing out students from the outside, from campuses across the country, into the prison. And it creates an opportunity for learning and sharing across multiple lines of difference between the different student populations and a way of really transforming, you know, these institutions of incarceration are meant to isolate and put aside people who we feel like have caused harm and should be punished. And it really dehumanizes them and creates a tremendous amount of violence of the spirit and material violence. And folks who are not incarcerated oftentimes have the privilege or buffer of not knowing that way of life. And if you have had that privilege, then it can really be out of sight, out of mind. You're unaware of how our society really treats those who have been considered punishable in these ways. And so it's a really important way to help folks who have not experienced incarceration to very much understand what our country is doing in these regards about how we deal with crime and punishment. And also for folks who are incarcerated to get an opportunity to be in a classroom with other scholars, students, and learn together in a transformative model where people are really concentrating on whatever. I mean, the class can be biology, sociology, literature, a variety of different class topics, but it's about coming together across these lines of difference and really learning together in transformative ways. And the ways that the classes are taught in this program are through a critical pedagogy, trauma-informed, sort of healing-centered approach like I propose in the book. It really is about sitting in a circle and having dialogue together and wrestling with theories and concepts and trying to put them into action in real time through the discussion across these groups of people who would otherwise probably not meet.
So how important is trust building in a setting like that? And how does that relate to setting up an environment in which the focus can be on well-being and healing and being sensitive to people's trauma, the trauma they've experienced.
Building community, building trust, learning how to show up as our full and whole selves and see each other in that way is a critical part of, democracy, right? Learning how do we learn to live together across our lines of difference and foster relationships and build trust and a sense of belonging across many different ways in which we are different, we are still interconnected. So the trust building part is crucial for any classroom, and in the Inside Out classroom in particular, because of the circumstances of learning together in the prison. So for example, I had a student on the very first class I taught. I taught one of the first classes of our Inside Out program at my university 10 years ago. And there were all these guards in the room and prison administrators. And we had our 10 students from the college and the 10 students from the prison. And we were kind of crammed into a small space. And we intentionally have the students sit in a circle, one from the inside incarcerated sitting next to one from the outside not incarcerated, and we do that throughout the whole circle. So you're completely commingling amongst ourselves. And one of the students later told me, one of the incarcerated students told me, he had not spoken to anyone who wasn't an inmate or a guard for 3 years, and he was so anxious and nervous to speak to someone from the outside that he said he almost threw up in the middle of the class. He was so nervous. But by the end of the two-hour class session, not only was he not throwing up, but he was completely elated and couldn't believe how well he could relate to and connect with these students, which on the outside might look like they have nothing in common in terms of race, class, and gender, and even political beliefs. But through the trust-building exercises and community-building exercises, people found the lines of commonality across the lines of difference and really investigated the conditions that led to their different life experiences and opportunities. Similarly, a student from the outside, from my campus, said to me at the end of the first class, "I didn't know anything about criminals except from what I saw on TV and in the news. And then when I got there and spoke to these guys, I realized that they're human like anyone else. That guy over there reminded me of my brother, and that other guy reminded me of my uncle." And I wish that humanizing effect happened more often, and it can happen more deliberately when we really put attention in our educational spaces to build that community.
Does some of this relate to the equity-centered component of this approach? Again, we're talking about what you present as trauma-informed, equity-centered healing education. Tell us about this component and what it means to center considerations of equity.
There's a wonderful quote by Bayo Komolafe that says, "Not everyone is given the right to be seen as traumatized. It can be a racial privilege." So many people go through intensely traumatic experiences, often related to injustice, but aren't always afforded the support, diagnosis, acknowledgement of trauma because of racism in society. So that's part of what it means by having an equity-based approach in trauma-informed education. The other part of it is some of us, because of race and class and other privileges, have protective factors that buffer the effects of trauma, including strong support systems and relationships with reliable adults and caregivers. So if a traumatic experience happened to you as a child, but you had a lot of people who were there to care for you and protect you and buffer you and provide some therapeutic healing for you in that moment, you may not be traumatized by that event because of the protective factors. Otherwise, if you don't, you may not, because one of your caregivers has gotten ill or been incarcerated, or any other number of issues. If you don't have that protective layer, then you might feel the trauma more strongly. These can happen because of, again, issues of inequity that exist for some and not others, and how much protective factors and buffers we have. You know, if you have health insurance versus not, that's gonna have a major impact in your life. So all of these, there's all kinds of different buffers or protective factors that shield us from inequity and or trauma. And that's an important part to consider when we're talking about this.
Some students come to school without having their basic needs met, right? So if you don't have consistent access to food, clothing, and shelter, as well as psychological and physical safety, you're likely going to be hindered from being able to concentrate on or contribute to your academics to the same degree as your more resourced peers, right? So for all students in our institutions to actualize the promise of student success, we have to make sure that they actually have what they need to do so. It's not a level playing field, right? And so this can be impacted by school policy, programs, and how we teach in our classrooms and the ways in which we take care of the different needs of students and how they show up. Going back to the example of teaching in prison, on one of my first day of classes, I asked my incarcerated students what accommodations existed for them. And they just kind of looking at each other, not sure what I was saying. And they finally, someone said, what do you mean by accommodations? And I said, well, in my college classrooms on campus, if you have a disability ranging from you have a wheelchair access needs, or you have ADHD or dyslexia, there are accommodations that are made to assist you so that you have the chance to succeed like everyone else. So if you need more time on an exam, or you need a ramp to get into a classroom, those things are there for you so you can access the learning experience equitably. And the students inside the prison just sort of laughed, and they're like, yeah, no, there's no accommodations in here. You know, it's incredibly difficult, especially in these deteriorating prisons, if you have accessibility needs physically to get around. And otherwise, there's no other sort of help or compensation made if you have other kinds of learning or mental disabilities. And they said, but we are each other's accommodations. We help each other out in the classroom. If someone needs help because they don't understand or can't do the reading because of some learning ability they're negotiating, we'll help each other out. We'll do the reading to each other. Or if someone can't access a building, we'll pick them up and carry them inside. And so that kind of deep level of commitment to care for each other and support each other is something I wish we could bring back more fully into all spaces of our classrooms, even when there is state or systemic things in place to offer support. At the same time, I believe it also is incumbent on the state or the structure of the classroom to offer that to students, to make sure that everybody has the chance to succeed no matter what you show up with when you come to classroom. If you haven't had the money to eat and you still need to concentrate in class, how can you still be having the chance to succeed? So that's part of what it means by being equity-centered when we're thinking about trauma too, is understanding how and why different people face and show up with what they do to the classroom. It's not just, you know, out of nowhere. It's oftentimes based on very real repercussions of sexism, racism, classism that exist in our communities, violence that some communities experience, surveillance, policing, all of those things. And just bringing that to mind when we're talking about how to create a classroom ecology that really, really is grounded in equity and trauma-informed care.
This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm C.S. Song. Tessa Hicks Peterson joins me. The book is Liberating the Classroom, Healing and Justice in Higher Education. She is a professor of urban studies and assistant vice president of community engagement at Pitzer College. She's also co-editor of Practicing Liberation, Transformative Strategies for Collective Healing and Systems Change, and the author of Student Development and Social Justice. So on a concrete level, what can teachers do in classroom settings to be sensitive to and address the trauma that students may be bringing into the classroom because of their backgrounds and experiences, and to act in a more equity-centered way, to be sensitive and, again, respond to people who may have suffered more from exposure to injustice than others?
So I think the most important thing is to develop caring and reliable relationships in the classroom. And for this teacher to be really present and self-aware and practicing humility and patience and flexibility as a model for the students, and also sharing their own narratives, if they're willing to share a little bit from their own lives, to also model what it means to be human and to make mistakes and to show up as your full self. That really helps students feel less scared about failing, about not being enough, and knowing that maybe their teacher also understands and is relatable in that way. I think it's such an opportunity for mentoring, although we don't talk about that a lot as teachers. We really concentrate on transferring knowledge to the student, but they're more than just a brain, a vessel for inheriting our important information. They are full beings who come with their own knowledge and their own culture and their own experiences and biases and wounds, and they need to be able to show up as their own full human selves and to learn with us. And I think there's so many ways that we can create a classroom that will imbue a sense of community in the classroom space, which then allows us to disagree and have conflict that is generative, that we can learn from and grow from rather than be afraid of having hard conversations, allows students to learn how to strengthen that muscle for discomfort or agitation that comes from learning different things that might go against what we believe, or to have conversations with people who have different opinions. And we need that muscle in society today more than ever, but we have to teach ourselves how to do that well, how to disagree well, how to show up together, how to care for each other across, again, lines of difference. And so there's very tangible ways to do that. It doesn't even take a lot of time. I think a lot of teachers feel completely stressed out by how much content, disciplinary content, they need to teach in the time they have. And they feel like there's not room for anything else.
And when you say disciplinary content, you're talking about the content of the area of study.
Yes. So I have to teach this much information in this history class or literature class or economics class or whatever class you're teaching. And I think to sometimes less is more, take out a little bit of the readings maybe for a class. This is at the college level that I'm speaking to, and try to spend a little more time on creating community. And the student well-being factor and the care and trust that happens in the community of the classroom will allow students to learn and achieve so much better. And so it's well worth the investment in time. And this can take place through, you asked for some concrete activities. One of the first things I do on the first day of school is we create ground rules for communication. What do we need to have in this classroom to have it be a brave enough space for us to show up fully and engage fully, and to have trust and open and honesty and patience and flexibility? The students come up with the ideas of what they need together. We write them on the board, and we keep ourselves accountable to creating a respectful community that can handle learning together in a time of great peril, meaning our society right now. We also talk about ourselves a little bit. So we will do pair shares, stories of our names. So you get in a pair with another person and you tell them the story of one of your names, first, middle, or last name you get to choose. And what's the story that you've inherited? You know, my mom came up with this name because she saw it on a telenovela and liked the character. Or this was my great grandfather's name passed down three different generations and it means this. Or, you know, we have so many different stories that come with through our names that tell a little bit about our culture or our traditions or our family, sometimes our traumas and our dramas, and sometimes beautiful pieces that we don't often share with each other. So it's just a small way to get to know each other, remember each other's names in the classroom, and then also to get a sense of who we are and the intercultural experience of being in a room together with different people coming from different places. I do other kinds of get to know you activities where they move in and talk in different groups about everything from if you could be a superhero, what would you be? What would be your superpower? To more deep questions like where are you from culturally, geographically, and politically? Whose shoulders do you stand on to be here today? I have a lot of different prompts that I use as icebreakers. And it doesn't take that long to do these activities, but it really creates a sense of coming to know each other in the classroom in a more deep way that will aid in our individual learning and self-awareness and the group conversations that we have that can sometimes be hard when we're talking about difficult topics. I also promote teachers taking time to facilitate embodied practices that will bring self-regulation. And by that, I mean, you know, when you're stressed or suffering from trauma or even just everyday anxieties, our nervous system can get a little hijacked and it can result in impairing our neurological functioning. So when you're super stressed, it can be hard to remember things, hard to concentrate. You know, your brain is not functioning optimally because the nervous system is taking over with its stress and all the different chemicals that come rushing through your body as a result. And so there are very simple practices from mindfulness traditions that you can do that help you to just self-regulate that nervous system a bit, enough so you can slow down a little bit that cascading chemical reaction inside so that you can regain a little more grounding in your neurological functioning so your brain and heart and spirit can be a little more grounded and present to the learning that's taking place. And I'll just spend a few minutes at the beginning of class reminding students to put their feet on the floor and take some deep breaths and try to relax their bodies, unfurl some tension that exists, you know, your shoulders, your neck, the tiny muscles behind your eyes. Just take a moment to relax and breathe into the spaces of tension and see if you can exhale out some of the stress. And by bringing attention to the body, to the breath, to the present moment, and practicing together in silence, some breathing, a little bit of movement. Sometimes we'll do stretching. Sometimes we'll stand up and shake out our limbs and put on some music and dance around a little bit. I mean, you can really do anything, and you don't have to be a trained practitioner to know how to breathe or how to move. It's all of our birthrights to do these things, and most of our traditions have taught in some way how to become center, present, and grounded. And drawing on those traditions and bringing them into the classroom, I can't tell you how it just shifts the energy in the room, in the individual bodies and the collective body of our community. When we do a little bit of that, it brings people to attention. You know, my students are just addicted to their screens and there's so much stress and anxiety happening. And when we just put everything down, close the computer, turn off the phone, and get present to our bodies and our breath and our presence with one another in the room, it shifts the energy and it really changes the concentration for the discussion and the work that we have to do in the class that day.
Tessa Hicks Peterson talking about her book, Liberating the Classroom, Healing and Justice in Higher Education. So we've been talking about trauma-informed, equity-centered healing education. You also do a deep dive into two other approaches you are advocating for in this book. One is an approach that promotes thriving and flourishing, and an approach that centers critical pedagogy. Rather than ask you to speak about each of these in sort of an analytical way, I wonder if you could do what you do in this book, which is to illustrate or apply or show how these approaches manifest themselves or could manifest themselves in a certain setting. The setting that you present, and you present many settings, but one setting you present is a session of the Inside Out Prison Exchange Program, when the topic of how to shield young boys from toxic notions of masculinity came up. What happened?
The class that you're mentioning here came up last summer when I was teaching inside the local prison where I've been teaching for 10 years. And we were in a discussion, as you mentioned, about how to shield young boys from toxic notions of masculinity. And a member of the class, who I call Carlos, shared that in his family and culture, the greatest act of love someone could show is being willing to sacrifice their life through violence for their loved one. And he told us this story about when his parents and his auntie showed up the first time he was threatened by violence on the street, and they showed up and protected him and fought for him as a way to demonstrate. And for him, he said this was the most tender demonstration of how much he was loved by his family. At that point in the conversation, another man, a black man, Carlos was Puerto Rican and Darnell was black. And this is important to mention because in the prison, there are strict racial rules of segregation. And the classroom is one of the only spaces where folks are integrated. So to come across race lines in the classroom is one of the only spaces where folks are brought together, and it can create some tension if there's disagreements along those race lines. So this is why I note they were coming from different racial experiences and they also different life experiences. And Darnell challenged Carlos's statement and said that he thought that, you know, thinking that a tender demonstration of how much you're loved by your family is when they're willing to be violent for you as a result of patriarchy and toxic masculinity. And he said, we have to change these ideas for teaching our boys, our young men into the future. The idea of violence being a manifestation of love is not one we need to pass on. And this was a tense moment holding their two different life experiences and beliefs. And right then, one of my graduate students from my campus, who was there in the class with us, she raised her hand and asked if she could share that today would have been her brother's 27th birthday, but that he had died in an act of violence to protect her sister. And so she looked Carlos in the eye and said, thank you for your words. I really understand where you're coming from. And then she looked Darnell in the eye and said, thank you for your words. I also understand where you're coming from. My brother's actions were a result of the violent systems that he was raised in. And now we no longer have him with us. And I don't know what to say about that to his three young sons. And we sat together in the tension and the reality of what it means to live in a society where love and violence are intertwined in very intense ways. And many people in that room had been afflicted by their entanglement in love and violence. And, you know, there's a lot of things that can be done in that moment to really sort of take apart the different pieces of this puzzle. Carlos, who made the statement that his family's act of violence as protection against for him was the greatest act of love he had experienced. You know, one of my questions about that is if the cultural ethics of his lineage of being Puerto Rican had this belief, or if that belief was acquired in the face of colonization and racism. And where have we all learned norms about violence and love at the level of family and culture and school and religion and government, right? So there's an opportunity there for us to really grapple with a structural analysis of power and where and how we understand violence and how certain marginalized populations suffer violence from above and perpetuate violence as protection from below, right? And who has the privilege in life to be buffered from cycles of violence and who does not.
And that is the critical pedagogy approach you're referring to in your book, right? That's where that kind of element comes in.
Yes. So really studying where, how, when, why our original cultures and present day communities have been socialized into dominant norms. How do we understand issues of power? And oftentimes we think the experiences we're having are just personal ones, but they're really often emblematic of larger structural issues. My biracial niece used to say, I have so low self-esteem. I don't like my thighs or my hair or my body. And as a biracial Black and white woman, I think that's not just low self-esteem. I think those are messages that come from our society about what kind of thighs and hair you're supposed to have in this society to be deemed beautiful. And her having thick thighs and curly Black hair was not what she saw in the fashion magazines of skinny blonde women. You know what I mean? So really looking at, we think we have these personal problems, but oftentimes they're emblematic and totally embedded in larger dominant norms and structural issues around power. And really having students think critically about their lives and their personal experiences and how we zoom out to see ourselves as the fish in water and understand what that water is.
The book we're talking about is Liberating the Classroom, Healing and Justice in Higher Education. It's published by Johns Hopkins University Press. My guest, the author of the book, is Tessa Hicks Peterson, Assistant Vice President of Community Engagement and a Professor of Urban Studies at Pitzer College. The program is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm C.S. Song. And what about the thriving and flourishing approach you foreground in this book? How might that apply, or how did that apply to this vignette that you're describing?
So the conversation in class that day came about because we were reading a wonderful book by another person you interviewed one day called Kazu Haga and his book on healing resistance. And that was the book we were reading that resulted in that conversation. So I came back to Kazu and told him about this experience with my students. And he responded with a deepening of this inquiry and said, it seems to me that what Carlos was honoring and receiving as love was the act of protection and willingness to sacrifice for him. I wonder if it would be possible for him to separate the violence from the courage and the sacrifice, and if he would feel the same way if they were willing to use nonviolence to sacrifice themselves and protect him. I imagine what made him feel love was their sacrifice, not necessarily the strategy they used to express it. I thought that was such a beautiful and a thoughtful analysis. And so thriving and flourishing is like, how can we live our lives in ways that allow each of us individually and collectively to thrive and flourish? And that might mean looking at the different strategies we use for standing up to discrimination or violence and all of these things. How can we actually keep in mind the other individual, even if you're someone on the other side of a baton with a cop, that cop is still a human. His acts or her acts of violence against you dehumanize them. And none of us should be dehumanized. You're dehumanized by being hit by the baton, and you are dehumanizing by being the one holding the baton. And we are in these structural power dynamics that are horrible for everyone, and obviously worse for those who are being violently oppressed and suppressed. But we all need to get out of these dynamics of these systems. And so thriving and flourishing looks at the larger picture of like, how do we as a survival, as a species, thrive and flourish? Not just survive, but thrive in our lives. And that means we have to not only push back using the ideas of critical pedagogy and to really critically assess and analyze and push back against these systems, but to think, how will we thrive instead? How will we create ways that we can come together and even navigate conflict in ways that are generative rather than destructive, where we can retain our humanity in these very intense times of conflict, where we can have autonomy over our bodies while also still feeling interconnected between and among us. And those are really maybe complex or lofty goals, but they're also the most basic piece of survival of our species. The way we've survived this far is by being interconnected. We have to look out for each other. There's no way the species will survive without it. And we see it in the natural world through biodiversity, right? You have plants and animals that are constantly communicating with each other and working so because we need all the other ones to survive so we can survive since we're all completely interdependent. So really bringing those ideas back into our everyday lives as teachers, as students, as human beings, how can we thrive individually and also collectively knowing that we need each other? And what do we need to do? Put attention to maybe a little less attention on competition, isolation, and hyperproductivity and hyperindividualism, and more attention on how do we collectively flourish? What do we need to take care of our well-being and each other and treat each other well so that we can survive together and even thrive in that process.
There seems to be a lot of talk about the sensitivity of students in relation to certain topics brought up in the classroom and to what extent they, you know, should be exposed to a certain topics, certain assertions, certain discussions. You write that while students always have the right to feel psychologically and physically safe in a classroom, they also need spaces and tools that enable them to bravely lean into discomfort rather than shy away from fraught topics altogether. Elaborate on that.
We're in this balancing act where, you know, there's a lot of harm that is committed every day, especially against marginalized identities. And it's really difficult for people to feel safe and well in a world that often targets them for who they are. At the same time, this is the world we live in, and we are not going to always feel good. We're going to face a lot of discomfort. And sometimes, if we can lean into the discomfort, that's where some of our greatest learning can occur. And now, it shouldn't occur at the expense of our well-being, but we also have to learn how to be both really open and loving and kind so that we can feel well together, and also resilient and strong enough and not so fragile that we can't withstand the discomfort of being around people who have different ideas and thoughts and beliefs, so that we can actually sit through it and try to understand each other and try to find out what people's motives or beliefs and values are and where there's lines of connection between us and where we might create some understanding, even across very disparate political points of view and whatnot. I think students have to be really held accountable to staying in the room and showing up for hard work while also being, you know, not subjugated to being demeaned or humiliated. There's a balance there of how do we create safety enough so that you can be uncomfortable. And that's going to be different for each body, depending on what you're experiencing in your family and your race and your culture and tradition, what feels safe to you or what doesn't. And we can't actually promise safety for everyone because we all have different ways of defining that for ourselves. But what we can try to do is make it safe enough for us to be brave enough to show up and handle some hard topics together and really lean into some of where the discomfort exists, knowing that there's this great analogy of, you know, the diamond, it starts off at coal, and the only way it comes to be a diamond is by tolerating a great deal of agitation. You put your dirty clothes in the washing machine, they have to go through the agitation cycle to come out clean. We have to be able to be sturdy enough to really confront some agitation and discomfort in order to come through to the other side. And how do we give our students the skills to be able to stay in a conversation and not just think in black and white ways, but be willing to sit with the nuance and complexity of different points of views? And that's a skill that will serve them well as trying to make sure that they feel, you know, that their well-being is cared for.
So we've talked about just really a portion of this book, Liberating the Classroom. What do the other chapters in it address?
So they talk about both the big picture and the more finite in the classroom picture. There's a great saying that was brought to my attention by the wonderful author of Healing Resistance, Kazuhaga. And it says, we do not rise to the level of our expectations. We fall to the level of our training. So a lot of this book is really exploring what training do we need in order to create the successful students we want in life that are successful not only in getting a job, but successful in being full, well humans who can contribute to society with a sense of purpose and belonging. And if we want to do that, we have a lot more training that we have to do of ourselves as teachers and as administrators and the policies and programs and structures of the school spaces that we create, and also as students participating in the learning process. The book, I start with just locating myself and my own educational experiences that have spanned from public to private to independent and all kinds of different learning school spaces that I was a part of, K through graduate school, and also the informal learning spaces that changed my life outside of schooling structures that I think are equally important. And I do that so that others reading the book will also take a moment to reflect on where and how they have learned and where they have thrived and felt whole in their education, so that we can really mine the things that work and think about those that don't. I spend the first part of the book looking at the issues that we face in higher education and some of the root conditions that have led us there that are emblematic of the larger dominant norms of society. I talk about bigger spheres of change that we need in institutions of higher education, according to issues of financial aid, salaries, diversity in faculty and student bodies, an array of large issues and how we can address them. And then I talk about the alchemy of change making, which means if we are going to change our institutions, it takes individuals coming together to really think through in strategic and intentional ways how to shift the needle. And I talk specifically about how we can do that in our institutions of higher education between faculty and students and administrators working together to really shift paradigm shifts in the institution for how the work is done. And I talk about it in specific ways and also actually how to facilitate change with groups of people. So that's sort of more the how and the why. And then the last part of the book, the final part of the book, concentrates on healing injustice in the classroom and gets into stories and theories and applications of trauma-informed, equity-centered education, thriving and flourishing in the classroom, and finally critical pedagogy. And so those are three domains of actually how to change the pedagogy, the how we teach and how we learn in classroom spaces. So the book goes from the broad, more paradigm shifts in higher education on a structural systemic level to the more specific, how do we do it in the classroom as teachers and students? It ends with a coda about what it means to have beloved accountability, be accountable to each other in creating these types of personal, interpersonal, and systemic change.
Tessa Hicks Peterson, Professor of Urban Studies and Assistant Vice President of Community Engagement at Pitzer College. We've been talking about her book, Liberating the Classroom, Healing and Justice in Higher Education. Thank you, Tessa, for writing this book and for joining us today.
Thank you so much. And can I say one last thing as we close?
Yes.
Everything that I've said here, I think, seems rather logical and makes sense, but it's so hard to do. And there's real obstacles and constraints and limitations to doing this work. But I don't think that's enough to keep us away from really illustrating for ourselves what a North Star of change could look like, even if we can't get there immediately, but to begin to chip away at some of our old habits that don't work and to create new norms around healing and liberation and justice that will be seeded now and that we continue to work for. So I don't want to just think this is easy and lovely and fun. It's hard work, but I want us to continue to have multiple voices, which there are now, of people saying, this is what we need to do and we can do it. And we can push against that which stops us and slowly but surely make those changes that we need.
And that interview was recorded on December 26th, 2024. And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.